Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Anil Naidu, coordinator of the Blue Planet Project, who reports on the disappointing results of the recently concluded United Nations Climate Summit in Cancun, Mexico. Michelle Berlin, a physician and researcher at Oregon Health and Science University, who discusses the findings of the 2010 National Women's Health Report Card. And Kevin Bankston of the Electronic Frontier Foundation, who takes a critical look at the calls in the U.S. for the prosecution of WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange for his release of thousands of embarrassing diplomatic cables. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
The new Multidimensional Poverty Index, released in November as part of the United Nations Development Program's Human Poverty Index, increased by 300 million the number of poor people, totaling 1.7 billion across the globe. The MPI raised poverty rates in both low-income and middle-income countries. In Ethiopia, the poverty rate doubled using the new methodology. While the World Bank described only 39% of Ethiopians as extremely impoverished, the new broader MPI index defines 90% of that population as meeting three or more indicators of poverty. Meanwhile, the MPI methodology has met stiff resistance from established agencies like the World Bank and the U.S. Agency for International Development. A top economist at USAID discouraged using the new poverty index in making funding decisions on development projects. But the MPI index was embraced by Carlisle Levine, a top technical advisor to the humanitarian agency CARE, who observed, "For us, it is added information that helps us back up our arguments for making the sort of investments we make." In the midst of the worst housing crisis in decades, the Federal Reserve has proposed amending the 1968 Truth in Lending Act to make it more difficult for homeowners to fight foreclosures and escape from predatory loans. A coalition of labor, civil rights, and senior citizens groups are fighting the Fed's proposed changes in consumer finance laws. Consumer activists are also seeking to give the power to amend the Truth in Lending Law to the new Consumer Finance Protection Bureau. According to McClatchy newspapers, the fight is over the Fed's push to water down the right to rescission, which gives consumers the right to challenge predatory loans up to 3 years after the closing date. Under the Fed's proposal, a homeowner seeking a loan rescission would have to pay off the balance of the loans before a lien is lifted. For decades, lawyers from the American Association of Retired Persons have used the right to rescission to help senior citizens escape from predatory loans. A homeowner can use the same clause in the law to fight a pending foreclosure. For the last 2 years, the debate over natural gas drilling in the Northeast has focused on the controversial practice of hydraulic fracturing of shale rock, which taps rich natural gas fields but is also thought to contaminate drinking water supplies. In coming weeks, the drilling debate will expand to the more conventional techniques used for drilling exploratory wells. In early January, the Delaware River Basin Commission, which regulates water and land issues in sections of Pennsylvania, New York, New Jersey, and Delaware, will hold a hearing on the potential environmental risks from exploratory drilling. According to the ProPublica news agency, the commission's plan to regulate natural gas drilling was challenged by the North Wayne County Property Owners Alliance, who are backed by Hess Corp and Newfield Exploratory Company. Meanwhile, Delaware Riverkeeper Network and other environmental groups are challenging exemptions given to 11 Pennsylvania-based exploratory drilling projects. Experts hired by the environmental groups say exploratory wells are more potentially polluting than natural gas production wells because hazards near the drilling site are not known. In addition, chemicals used in the construction of exploratory wells could leak into the groundwater of the Delaware River Basin. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Leslie Rudden.
Dead delegates from 194 nations around the world gathered in Cancun, Mexico in early December for this year's UN Climate Conference. Government representatives and climate activists who traveled to the Caribbean resort city were working in the shadow of last year's failed climate conference in Copenhagen, where no agreement on an international treaty to reduce carbon emissions that cause global warming was reached. The summit meeting produced a non-binding document where countries' stated goal is to cut carbon emissions that will limit the temperature rise below 3.6 degrees Fahrenheit. Measured against the failure of the Copenhagen summit, most delegates viewed the Cancun conference as a success, but many critics label the outcome of the negotiations as inadequate. Bolivia was the one nation at the summit that strongly opposed carbon reduction targets negotiated in Cancun as too weak. Bolivia's chief negotiator, Pablo Solon, expressed the sentiments of Bolivian President Evo Morales when he said, "Cancun does not represent a step forward, it is a step backwards, because the non-binding commitments made to reduce emissions by around 15% by 2020 simply cannot stabilize temperature at the level which is sustainable for human life and the life of the planet." Between the lines, Scott Harris spoke with Anil Naidu, coordinator of the Blue Planet Project. Speaking from Cancun, he reported on the disappointing results of the climate summit and what activists need to do in advance of next year's final UN climate summit in Durban, South Africa, to renew the Kyoto Protocol before it expires in 2012.
Copenhagen was a failure, remains a failure, and this entrenching of the Copenhagen Accord under these Cancun agreements is also certainly in our eyes a failure. The two cannot be dissociated from each other because what has happened over these last two climate summits is really an attack on the Kyoto Protocol, which, even though it is flawed, is now the only binding UN convention on climate change and is a legal system that we must respect. What is happening is that is being supplanted with something now that is not binding and which is will lead the world towards increased warming and actually tilts the way that we're viewing climate in favor of market mechanisms and a future where there is not a recognition of the equity principles that were in Kyoto. And those refer to the fact that the 37 what are called Annex I countries have a larger proportion of the responsibility to deal with climate change than developing countries, because these countries have actually caused the problem to this point. So that's part of what's going on with linking Copenhagen and Cancun, and we have to recognize that. Even around those things that have been claimed to be successes, there are no mechanisms, no talking about where the money comes from. It's just a number, essentially. And this seems to have been enough to entice many southern governments to accept this deal, and I think partially because they saw very clearly that they were not going to get anything else from developed countries, because on day one, Japan said no Kyoto 2, no movement towards second commitment phases with Kyoto. It was very clear the direction this was going, and so in pragmatic realpolitik terms, this was the best that could be hoped for, and also the multilateral process needed to be saved, essentially, even if it was a bad deal, because the world could not abide, certainly, a Copenhagen failure and then a Cancun failure. It would have essentially destroyed the system as we know it anyway. And many governments that did not want to be bound by Kyoto understood this and played that kind of political game, both with the money side and with pushing the multilateral process and dividing developing countries' solidarity, certainly.
Anil, tell us about the role of the Bolivian government. They were a strong voice of opposition to the agreements that emerged out of Cancun. What were the Bolivians objecting to primarily?
Today, I think that all people that care about the climate should consider themselves Bolivian and stand in solidarity with the Bolivian government, because they were severely punished after Copenhagen, because they, again, said that was a very bad deal and bad outcome, and the process had been disrupted and not respected. They were punished. Certainly $3 million was pulled in aid that the U.S. was giving Bolivia in terms of climate aid. But still the Bolivians moved forward and called together the Cochabamba People's Summit, which happened in April of this year, and brought together close to 40,000 activists and people related to social movements, and talked about true solutions to the climate crisis. Now, what Bolivia did was speak truth to power, because it held firm in the face of an agreement that will see the temperature rise 4 degrees this century, which will be devastating. What we're seeing now in terms of climate change is related to only a 0.8 degree rise. So the droughts, the desertification, the chaos, the all the flooding, all the impacts that are happening now, this is only related to a 0.8 degree rise. What the UNEP, United Nations Environmental Program scientists have said is that if Copenhagen is accepted, we're looking at a 5-degree rise in this next century. Devastating. So what Bolivia did was deny consensus to this, because it used the science, it showed the impacts. The Bolivian ambassador, Pablo Solon, laid out in a 25-minute speech the reasons that Bolivia was against this bad agreement.
What are the plans of environmental activists leading up to next year's climate summit in Durban, South Africa, given that there was certainly a range of opinions of what happened in Cancun, but generally I get from what you're saying, there's a lot more work that needs to be done to strengthen what happened in Cancun, Mexico.
Yeah, I mean, this is probably for me the most unfortunate thing, is that there's no coherence amongst climate activists on the direction to go. Many are saying, this is the best deal we could get, and, they're looking at the nice words without substance that were in that agreement. If you want to read into there the most positive aspects that you possibly could, you could fool yourself into thinking this was actually, headed in the right direction. But I think that any deep reading of it, any understanding of how much this has damaged Kyoto and any legally binding mechanisms, and that money alone cannot in any way solve this problem, will lead you to know that we're really in trouble. And some of the biggest NGOs were very positive about this deal. And for me, that's very disappointing. There are a small group, Friends of the Earth and a few others that we work with, that have been very much clearer in my mind about the fact that you can't negotiate the science, can't negotiate with the climate. There are very hard targets that need to be met, and the consequences are now well known. So all the kind of dancing around the language and the power politics that are being played in the end will lead us to ruin and destruction.
That was Anil Naidu, coordinator of the Blue Planet Project. Contact the group at area code 613-233-2773 or visit their website at blueplanetproject.net. For the past 10 years, researchers at Oregon Health and Science University have collaborated with the National Women's Law Center to produce a women's health report card. The data collected from many sources is used to develop status indicators and assess public policy options, like restricting tobacco sales and use, for example, which resulted in a drop in smoking among women. The new report, titled Making the Grade on Women's Health, a National and State-by-State Report Card, shows that despite some progress on individual health status indicators, overall the nation is still far from meeting key women's health objectives and received a grade of unsatisfactory. The study notes a major increase in obesity among women, as well as binge drinking, and a drop in women receiving important health screenings, such as pap smears to detect cervical cancer. Between the Lines, Melinda Tuhu spoke with Michelle Berlin, a physician and researcher at Oregon Health and Science University, who worked on the report. She says results of the report are disappointing and discusses possible reasons for the deficiencies.
One of the ones I'm the most worried about is obesity. I mean, it's dramatically increased from just under 20% in 2000 to more than 26% in 2010. And when I look at the report card as a whole, there are other indicators that go along with that one that are really concerning to me. So, for example, the proportion of women who have been found to have high blood pressure has gone up. And what do we know that makes a difference for? Well, if you have women who have increasing rates of diabetes and they're more obese, they have high blood pressure, and they're not eating correctly, if they're not eating enough fruits and vegetables, down the line, that's likely to mean we're going to see more people who have heart attacks and strokes. So it's really quite worrisome.
Why do you think drops in these various health indicators have occurred? Do you think there's any correlation or any connection to the severe recession the U.S. is experiencing, where people are maybe not able to access health care?
Yes, I really do, particularly for pap screening. It's gone nationally from almost 85% to 78%. And I think there are a number of factors. One of them is without a doubt the issues of the recession. And so some of the health insurance things I mentioned before about women who don't have health insurance, women who have only catastrophic insurance, and women who whose insurers require them to pay a copay for preventive services, that's a problem. Women know they need pap smears. That's not the issue. It's not an education issue that way. It's more, I think, access in the insurance issue. And I think there's something else, too, that we just shouldn't discount. I think in many families, women are the sort of help access health care for their families. And so if there's a choice between their partner or their children accessing health care or them, they're going to make sure that their family members get health care first. Women tend to take care of themselves last. And I'm not saying women should be selfish per se, but I think it's a big issue to take into account that, you know, if the mom's healthy or wife's healthy, it's going to help everybody else too. So I think that that's all that is coming to play at the same time, and it makes for a very difficult situation.
President Obama's health reform law has already improved access in some areas of health that specifically benefit women, various kinds of screenings without copays or deductibles, with more improvements coming down the road if it's not declared unconstitutional. How important is that to improving women's health status?
You know, I think that the Health Reform Act or the Affordable Care Act can make a big difference. One of the things that is part of its package is the concept of what's called a medical home, meaning a place or a virtual home, if you will, where everyone gets their care, and it's, their care is coordinated. So, for example, I'm a physician and I practice currently. If I am seeing a patient every 15 minutes and I want to help them quit smoking, I can start that process, but it's going to work a lot better if I then have someone else in my office who can follow up with them, talk to them for quite a bit more time, and call them up, see how they're doing, and help them access services, than if I'm trying to do this by myself. So I think the concept of a medical home can be extraordinarily helpful, and it should help with coordination of many different types of services, nutrition, you know, exercise, a lot of different things. So I think that matters a lot.
What's the next step beyond providing this good data about different aspects of women's health? What do you want to see come out of this survey?
We started this report card project about 10 years ago with two ideas in mind. One of them was to help provide researchers and health planners with good data in order for us to be able to say, here is data that we are comfortable you can use to help plan what you want to do. So that's one piece. The second is for people to talk to their legislators and policymakers and other stakeholders to say, you know, we're tired and we don't want to take this anymore, and we think we need your help to figure out how to get things changed, so that certain things can be put into legislation and can be required of health insurers, for example, if that's the way to go. Another one, again, in talking about smoking, is we know that the higher the excise tax, the higher the tax on cigarettes, the less likely young kids are to start smoking. So there's a lot of things that can be done that can help. The other set of things, too, are aspects of what is sometimes called the built environment. So that may mean helping to encourage mass transit in areas. I live in Portland, Oregon, and we have a pretty phenomenal public transit system, but part of what people don't talk about is you have to walk to it. That's a good thing in general. What other things can be done? There are some companies that have done things like make sure that their parking structure is a little bit farther away from the building, so you have to walk to get there. So there's a lot of public policy initiatives that can help encourage us to do the right thing and make it sort of easier to do.
That was Michelle Berlin, a physician and researcher at Oregon Health and Science University. For more information on the Women's Health Report Card, contact the National Women's Law Center at area code 202-588-5180 or visit their website at nwlc.org.
After spending a week in a London jail, a British judge granted WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange cash bail in the amount of £200,000 or $315,000 with strict conditions. But Sweden, which is seeking to question Assange in connection with his alleged sexual assault of two Swedish women, announced that it would oppose the granting of bail. WikiLeaks has drawn harsh criticism from many governments for its release of thousands of classified field reports on the U.S. wars in Iraq and Afghanistan this summer, and its more recent circulation of secret U.S. State Department cables exposing Washington's sometimes embarrassing confidential discussions of foreign policy and heads of state. Conservative politicians and commentators are ramping up the pressure to retaliate against Assange and WikiLeaks. Weekly Standard editor Bill Kristol has called for the assassination of Assange, and Connecticut U.S. Senator Joseph Lieberman has demanded Assange be charged with treason and that the New York Times be investigated for its publication of some redacted WikiLeaks documents. U.S. Attorney General Eric Holder maintains that WikiLeaks' release of secret documents has put the safety of Americans at risk, and says the Justice Department is investigating whether to prosecute Assange, possibly under the U.S. Espionage Act of 1917. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Kevin Bankston, senior staff attorney with the Electronic Frontier Foundation, who explains why he strongly rejects the constitutional basis for any prosecution of Julian Assange for his group's publication of documents that they did not themselves illegally obtain.
I fear that a lot of the hyperbolic and hysteric commentary about WikiLeaks has created more heat than light, isn't really clarifying to the situation. But I think regardless of whether you or I or anyone else think the release of the diplomatic cables by WikiLeaks was responsible or irresponsible or is overall a good thing or a bad thing for democracy in the U.S. or is journalistic or, to use a term that's been horribly overused lately, terroristic. The fact remains that our First Amendment strongly protects the right of WikiLeaks or the New York Times or you or I to publish and to read these cables. There's a lot of complaint about, well, you know, some of this may not be particularly newsworthy or why was it important for this stuff to be published? But it's not the burden of a publisher to demonstrate why what they're publishing is important. The presumption in our system is that if you are publishing it, it is important and it's protected. Rather, the burden is on the government, if it wants to restrain publication or prosecute somebody, to meet a very high burden and demonstrate that specific information in a specific cable is going to cause direct, immediate, irreparable harm to the United States. And if they can't do that, our First Amendment demands that the speech stay up. And ultimately, that is a bargain we've made as a country, and in the end, it's a powerful and important bargain, and one that we've staked our all on.
We hear that the U.S. Justice Department, under the Obama administration, is studying prosecution of Julian Assange, the founder of WikiLeaks. What legal standing does the U.S. Justice Department have to go after Julian Assange, who is an Australian citizen and certainly not subject to all U.S. laws, is he?
There are certainly practical concerns in terms of getting jurisdiction over Julian Assange. It is possible they would be able to extradite him from Sweden when he goes to face the separate sexual assault charges that have been brought against him there. It's a bit hard to comment on an indictment that hasn't come down yet and a criminal complaint that does not exist yet. But the law most often cited in regard to WikiLeaks is the Espionage Act of 1917, which rather broadly criminalizes the receipt or dissemination of national defense information. As you'll note, 1917, that's a very long time ago, and there have been a lot of intervening Supreme Court decisions on the First Amendment and reiterating how strong our First Amendment is and how strongly it protects our ability and the ability of the foreign press, to the extent they're speaking to us Americans, the right to publish true political speech. And that's exactly what we're talking about here when we discuss the documents of the United States government, which are by definition political speech and very strongly protected under our First Amendment. So I think the question we need to ask ourselves, though, if and when a prosecution is brought against Julian Assange. Is what's preventing such a prosecution against the New York Times or any other any innocent recipient of this information who attempts to report on it or publish it? Indeed, Senator Joe Lieberman, who's been the source of some of the most hysterical commentary here, has in fact suggested that the New York Times should be criminally investigated for reporting news based on these cables and for possessing these cables, which I think should send a shudder down the spine of any American who cares about free speech and a free press.
When Connecticut Senator Joseph Lieberman talks about investigating the New York Times and any other publication by extension that reprints portions of these leaked diplomatic cables published initially by WikiLeaks, what standing would that kind of investigation have without jeopardizing the constitutional guarantee of the right of a free press and free speech?
I think that such a prosecution would threaten the First Amendment rights of not just the person prosecuted, but everyone else, to the extent it would chill us, it would frighten us, it would create a fear around these documents that I don't think is warranted. And to try and create an antidote to that fear, what we've published on our site is a memo from the Congressional Research Service, or CRS, which is Congress's bipartisan objective legal office to write memos for them about what the law really is. And we have gotten a hold of a very recent memo from CRS about WikiLeaks and the laws that might apply and how the First Amendment might create hurdles to prosecuting WikiLeaks. And it makes very clear, and something we already knew, but I think that the public needs to hear more of, which is a prosecution against a publisher for publishing true information that they did not illegally obtain, but rather was provided to them, would be absolutely unprecedented in American law. It's something that just doesn't happen. That's a fact that I think a lot of the rhetoric here is ignoring. And I think that a prosecution of that nature would represent a sea change and pose a real new threat to our system of free speech.
That was Kevin Bankston, senior staff attorney with the Electronic Frontier Foundation. Contact the foundation by calling area code 415-436-9333 or visit their website at eff.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines by calling area code 203-268-8446 or write to Between the Lines, care of Squeaky Wheel Productions, P.O. Box 110176, Trumbull, Connecticut 06611. Visit our newly redesigned website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archived programs in MP3 and streaming audio, and subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mika Ta. This week's program is produced by Scott Harris, with the assistance of Richard Hill, Hank Hoffman, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Leslie Rudden, Gary Trujillo, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Denise Manzari.